amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W, and this week, JD.com abandoned its bid to buy FTSE 250 retailer Currys, the UK reported positive GDP growth for January, and EasyJet is getting ready to join the FTSE 100 in place of Endeavour Mining. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. There are much more interesting things going on to discuss, and to discuss them, I am joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve, and how has your week been?
Pretty dosed up at the moment, Steve. I've managed to pull my back. I don't know how I've managed to do it, but this is about as good as I've felt, and it doesn't feel that good. So if people think I'm slouching in my chair, it's because I'm slouching in my chair, because it's about the only way I get a decent amount of lumbar support in it. So yeah, I've had a pretty crap week, Steve. I've managed to open, the wind took my car door, and I've smashed it into the juniors in the worst possible place. So I've had to fork out to get that repaired, but... I don't know, Steve. I'm off today, so it can't go any worse. In terms of stocks, though, it's actually gone all right. I'm up about 0.55% on the week, which is... That's not too bad. I'm fairly happy with that. You told me it was in between the majors indexes, so... Well, the majors, but not the FTSE. I'm rather happy with that. How about you? How's your week been? How are your stocks doing?
I have been working basically non-stop this week, doing the same interview 45 times for various different admissions candidates. That's how I know it's the vacation, because I'm doing interviews and not teaching. It's been all right, that part of it. Bit boring, bit repetitive, but that's the way of things. It could be a lot worse, basically. And the same goes for the portfolio. I'm up 0.38%, roughly. I had to sort of work it out a little bit because I did some buying, but... That also puts me in basically where you are relative to everything else. So better than the S&P, slightly better than the S&P, slightly worse than the Vawirl, and comfortably worse than the FTSE 100, which has been having a very good week, which is not the way we normally think about things, but is the way things have been this time, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. One of our stocks, Steve, has had a very, very good, well, week and a bit, really. Southern Copper. I think it's raced up for you, past the 100 or the double for you, and for me it's on for about 175% at the moment. So this was a number of outfits picked for the worst performer of the year. They had Amazon down as the best performer and Southern Copper as the worst. And at the time, I remarked that. That was quite... I had mixed feelings about these two picks. But yeah, Southern Copper absolutely racing off on a couple of upgrades and a new decent grade of copper found in one of their prospects, Steve.
Yeah, that's done pretty well, which I think probably tells you everything you need to know about how the rest of my portfolio has been getting on this week. It has taken me back through the double mark. And actually, I'm sort of struck by, as I often am when this happens... exactly how fast the numbers go up once you get through the double. The step to 101 is much bigger than the step from 0 to 1, obviously, and much smaller than the step from 0 to 1. It feels like the kind of old Charlie Munger thing of you work really hard for the first 100k. I know this is 100%, not 100k, but after that things start to move a bit more straightforwardly, and you can let go a little bit. But bit of good macroeconomic news from the UK. The recession is over. If you blinked, you probably missed it, but we're still waiting for the news from February and March, of course, to give us the end of Q1. But things are reasonably positive back home. Steve, have you consumed anything any good this week?
There was a whole load of new books added to the Spotify premium library. So if you have a paid for Spotify subscription, you also now get audiobooks included in that, or a few audiobooks. Some of them you have to buy, some of them are included. One of the ones that got added was one of the ones that was on my list of things to read. So I thought, well, that'll do for driving to and from work. So I've been reading Rory Stewart's Politics on the Edge. Now, I am not really into politics whatsoever, but Rory Stewart's Politics on the Edge is pretty fun, really. If you want to know what the day-to-day ins and outs of a politician are and what they actually do, what kind of powers they have and don't have, especially in this sort of more modern sort of government-run sort of thing that we do at the moment. You might find that pretty interesting to check out. I've been pretty... It's funny in places. I think that sometimes you get the sense that he's maybe a little bit naive, or he was naive, or potentially... People tend to belittle him a little bit, I think, in the Tory party. But you can tell from his notes that he's very well aware of what they're trying to do and what he's trying to do. And it's a really interesting read. He has an interesting sort of anecdote, and it's quite funny in places, where he says that while Cameron was in government, the US Defense put up for their defense secretary, a CIA, somebody who used to run the CIA, a 4-star ex-Marine, and somebody who was a colonel in the army. And the UK had somebody who was a fireplace salesman who'd never worked outside of the UK. So, which kind of, you know, when you look at this sort of current crop, and the ex-crop of Conservatives, and when we said that, I think a couple of months ago, Steve, that I thought there was quite a lack of talent. They're scraping the barrel in the Tory party. I think we've been doing it for a very long time. But yeah, I recommend it. I'm only about 8 chapters in. Now, I don't know if that's 8 chapters in terms of chapters in the book, or 8 chapters in terms of just chapters of the audiobook. But yeah, it's a really interesting listen, and I'm really enjoying it. I'd recommend it.
Rory Stewart, probably your favourite Conservative politician that you can think of. I'd be surprised if there was anyone further ahead than that, Steve, but just run your mind through the other sort of 3 or 4 that you can currently name.
Yeah, well, the only one I was going to sort of put up there was, I always used to quite like Ken Clark, but I don't think I could name too many others, especially being brought up in a massively Labour town like Hull is. Very, very difficult to, you know, to get past liking any of them, to be honest.
Rory Stewart, of course, known to listeners of this podcast from your previous recommendation of The Rest Is Politics, I think, along with Alistair Campbell. But that's interesting. I've heard a lot of people who I don't associate as being Conservative voters. I don't know, of course, right? I only sort of know what they tell me, and there are quite a lot based on sort of recent election results of what we might call shy Tories, which is people who either keep quiet or say they're not voting Conservative and then do, because that's what the kind of election results seems to come out like. We'll see how that goes later, probably this year when we get to another election. But Rory Stewart does seem to be the person who sort of offends least people who would otherwise vote against vote against his party. So well worth a listen, maybe, even if you're not naturally aligned to his political affiliation, I guess.
What I was going to say, Steve, just before you carry on, he was a Labour youth, so he was in the Labour Party as a junior, and then went to teach at Harvard, and when he left Harvard to come back to basically attempt to enter politics, he thought about the things that most interested him, and one of those things was kind of rural affairs, really, and environment, and sort of like keeping history relevant. And he saw that because of that, the old-fashioned Tories was probably a better home for him than the Labour Party at that time. It just so turned out that he somehow managed to upset everybody and couldn't get a decent job doing anything for the whole time he was there. I mean, yeah, it's definitely interesting. You should I think just for the backstory, really, just check it out. He's not there's not like a massive history, you know, backlog of him starting when he was 1 year old or something like that. This isn't a biography of sorts. It's a collection of his notes of his time in Parliament, and he's pretty sharp, and he's definitely on point about you know, what he wants to say about the you know, the people that you may once have respected, the Camerons of this world, or you may have had maybe a little bit of you know, maybe you like them a little bit, maybe you like him a little bit less once you listen to it.
Interesting. I think I'm probably slightly more sympathetic to the Conservatives than you are, Steve. Not that that says very much kind of at all, and it is only slightly, but no, I think I'd probably put Cameron as clear blue water after him, the worst prime minister in my lifetime, is how I would characterize him, I think. So yeah, be interesting to find out more about that. I've been listening to Business Breakdowns again. This week's one was really, really good. It was with a guy called Ed Wackenheim, I think. Sorry about pronouncing his name. From a place called Greenhaven Associates. I think he's the founder of that fund. Their 13F, or a summary of their 13F, is available on places like Dataroma, if you're interested in what they hold. He's very much not one of these kind of closet indexers where the kind of biggest things he own is some form of big tech, and maybe you get some people who are a little bit choosy about their big techs, and maybe they own Apple but not Microsoft, or Microsoft but not Google, or not Tesla but maybe Meta, or something like that, right? There's people who are sort of more or less close to the index. He's quite a way away, and his sort of starting premise appears to be, and as he put it, if you want to kind of do better than the market, you will need to have some sort of thought that goes against the market, basically. You'll need to work out what you think the market is getting wrong and represent that in your portfolio. And here's his top 10 holdings, or the top 10 holdings of his organization. They are, in order, Lennar, which is a UK house builder, US house builder, sorry, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, General Motors, JP Morgan, CRH, which is effectively building materials, Poulter Group, which is more house building, Toll Brothers, which is more house building, WestRock, which is a packaging company, and DR Horton, which is yet another house builder. So you can see what he's kind of long here, or bullish on, broadly speaking, is banks and buildings. And for someone who wrote a piece called Bricks, Banks and Buildings a while ago for Motley Fool and got absolutely no traction with it, this guy has a natural affinity with me. Now, I didn't talk about house builders very much, but he does. He talks about DR Horton as his kind of business breakdown. I thought it was really interesting because it helped correct some misunderstandings I had about DR Horton and the US house building sector in general. So here's where I was at before, and here's where roughly where I got to after. So beforehand, I thought, look, there's two types of house builder, effectively. There's NVR, and there's everybody else. NVR's stock trades at around 17 times earnings, which makes it not terribly cheap. But it's miles better than all the other ones. The others trade at around 10, and they're all rubbish. And the reason they're different is that NVR doesn't use all its cash to go and buy land. What it does is use its cash to buy options and then buy the land once it knows that it can build a house and sell it on there, which helps remove the risk of plowing all your money into a massive parcel of land that you don't know you'll be able to build on. And it also allows you to return some of that cash to shareholders rather than whacking it into real estate, quite literally real estate here. One of the things that Ed Wackenheim told us about was that DR Horton, and in fact most of the US house builders, are in fact now following this model. It's just that the market doesn't seem to have switched onto it just yet. So Horton now options around 75% of its plots, and that means that they can, well, it means two things. Number one is they can pay out more to shareholders. They have the same model as NVR, just without people catching on. And they also have the US house builders significantly higher returns on equity than their UK counterparts. So with DH Horton, return on equity is around 21.6%, Lennar 15.9%, NVR 40%. In the UK, where you're looking at Barratt, it's about 3%, Taylor Wimpey 7%, Vistry 7%. So these are much, much, much lower numbers as a result of having a slightly different model. It caused me to think I want to look a bit more carefully at the UK house building sector, actually, because there are some interesting comparison points there, and I wonder how they might play out. But besides that, there's what you might consider to be essentially the obvious stuff of housing in almost constant demand and people sort of moving and wanting to get out of living at home. Older generations starting to pass down cash down to their children to help with deposits and so on. So boomers who effectively couldn't miss with their 13% interest rates if they just put the money basically anywhere. But some bought houses and watched those houses go up quite a lot, so they're now pretty well off. Standard stuff otherwise. Economies of scale from DH Horton means that you can set them up and just have them go like a conveyor belt, basically. But the really interesting thing I thought was the way that that US house building model has adapted, and trying to compare that to the UK is my sort of next project. I sometimes wonder why I bother doing any research on UK house builders when I talk to Steve every week. But it got me kind of thinking about house building again. And not just in terms of Forterra. Steve, you used to own DR Horton, right?
I did, and that's news to me as well. That's I was just looking then, Steve, at Lennar, D.R. Horton, and Toll Brothers, and they've all been fantastic winners over the last 5 years. Just looking at them quickly, Lennar up 229.75, so 230%. D.R. Horton up 273%, and Toll Brothers up 233%. You know, if you were a dart throwing monkey throwing at any of them, you would have been very happy with those returns. So yeah, that's really, really impressive. And like I say, the thing we like about NVR, or the thing we liked about NVR, which we thought was their unique sort of selling point, if everybody's doing that now, then that makes the whole sector a lot more attractive to me. So like you, I think it might be time to get some boots on and have another dig in. They're not trading at very rich valuations. I'd have to look and see if there's any kind of special earnings this year, although I wouldn't imagine the earnings would be too great. But Lennar is at 11.5 PE, D.R. Horton's at 11 PE, and Toll Brothers at 9.24. You know, we're talking about stocks that are up pretty much 250%, 50% a year here. Well, maybe not that much with compounding, but yeah, impressive, Steve. Yeah, I didn't know that, and yeah, really happy that you brought that up, to be honest.
Yep. So, Moss Building might be one to have another look at here. I mean, it's a really interesting episode, by the way, for having a listen to. For anyone that's interested in this, it's not a pitch from me particularly. It's more a recommendation for some listening that people might be interested in. But we've got plenty more to get on with, not just listening to me talking about podcasts that are not this one. We've got a question, and it's about retirement. It's from Sam Lates, who has asked a few questions and always left some very kind and helpful feedback for us. And he asks the following: how do you see your investing strategy changing, brackets if at all, when you approach retirement, or when you approach / reach retirement? Steve D, will you continue to orient towards growth? Steve W, will you continue to seek out value, or will you both look for more capital protection and income through dividend stocks and bonds? It's a good question. I mean, it feels like a very long way off for me, the kind of question about retirement, because when I sort of set out investing, I thought one of the reasons for investing would be that I'd just like to retire someday. That would be nice. Don't back my workplace pension particularly. Definitely don't feel like I can rely on the state pension. It feels like an increasingly difficult to maintain expense, and at some point that I think will go or be limited or not triple locked or something. And whether that will happen within my lifetime or not is probably touch and go. Whether they can keep this thing going just for that bit longer until I make it to the end, maybe, give it 50-50 chance, so not really worth kind of relying on. And the more I think about this kind of question of, do I plan on pivoting to what Sam called kind of capital protection and income, so I'm thinking maybe bonds and maybe sort of more defensive looking stocks like utilities and stuff, which have traditionally been the things that you buy for your pension, where demand is almost kind of guaranteed and dividends are almost kind of guaranteed as well. The short answer is, it really depends. It really depends, in my view, on the following. I would very much like to keep investing the way that I currently am, which is to say, I find it hard enough finding stuff to buy with the current fairly broad and fairly open remit that I have. I'm not a dividend investor, but I own some dividend stocks. I don't see myself as a growth investor, but I own some things that ought to grow. And I don't particularly see myself as any kind of investor, but I own things that you could fit into any given category. I mean, I own Citigroup, which is probably cheap, and that therefore makes me a value investor, most likely. I'd like to keep investing in whatever I think is best at any given moment, which is kind of how I think about things at the moment, because anything else seems really hard. The gritty reality of that is, if I find myself needing to draw down in retirement, then that might have to go a different way here. But I think one thing I'm aware of here is that if I can keep growing my portfolio enough, I might be able to be all right with the kind of income that I have from a combination of dividends and share buybacks. And the companies that I own and I tend to invest in a lot of cases, they're very big. But even where they're not big, they are largely fairly mature. So as a recent example, think sort of Doc Martens, which is not huge in the grand scheme of things. But in terms of massive growth runways, I'm not sure I see them rolling it out anywhere else particularly, which means they're in a kind of capital return stage. And by the time I reach retirement age, I would expect a lot or most of my investments to be there. And then it's a question of having the right management. If we've reached a point where, look, further growth investments are either too risky or unwise or just impossible, then it's time to start doing buybacks and dividends and whatever else. And we can, at the time, it's theirs to take a view on whatever they think is the best way of doing this. But whether it's by buyback or dividend, I sort of expect most things I own to be at that stage when I get to retirement. And then what I'll buy may well be an open question as to whether I'll want to keep buying things for kind of immediate short-term gratification, or whether I'll kind of look to keep things that I can perhaps pass along, which would be kind of nice. But Steve, do you have any thoughts on switching over to a dividend strategy or anything like that when you get to retirement or near retirement?
So no, I don't really believe in flight paths. I know this is going to be a strange way to start, but yeah, I don't really believe that portfolio should change as you get to retirement like that, unless you've got a massive pot. Like, for example, if you've managed to accrue 10 million and you realistically only wanted 500,000, then yeah, you're going to want to try and protect that capital as much as possible and strip all the volatility out and go for whatever minimum volatility portfolio you can get that will, you know, keep up with CPI. And you know, that's how you're going to want to run. But realistically, I think not a lot of people are going to get there. And the point is to get as much as possible. And I think a lot of people are still going to have to earn index level returns all the way through the retirement to be able to withdraw the 3 or 4 or 5% that they need to have a dignified retirement. So yeah, I don't believe in flight paths whatsoever. I think they're a sort of a part of history that we maybe need to forget about, especially as smaller capital retail investors. So my focus would be on. I mean, the likelihood is I would shove it all into something that I didn't want to manage. So it might be something like VWRP or VWRL, which I can sell down as and when I need it. But in terms of swapping to something like income or putting 90% of my portfolio in income, you know, corporate bonds or and gilts, and the other 10% in something that would appreciate, no, I won't be doing any of that unless I've got an absolutely massive monster pot that I need to sort of preserve. So yeah, I'll be pretty much the same. I might be an index investor by then, but we'll have to see.
Do you think in terms of safe withdrawal rates, Steve, at 3%, 4%, 5% and so on? I mean, there's a lot of kind of theory on that, but I suppose I'm sort of slightly skeptical about exactly how far these kind of things are to be taken seriously. Partly because I think safe withdrawal rate mostly depends on a lot of things like where interest rates are at any given moment. I mean, my sort of thought is exactly what kind of dividend yield I could get by switching into dividend stocks will depend on where interest rates are at the time, right? If they're, and that's far enough in advance, I don't even want to start trying to predict where they might be. If I were really, really gun to the head, forced to bet, I would guess they'll be on the floor, because that seemed to be the rough plan until COVID arrived, that interest rates were never going to go up, that we would just keep kind of stimulating forever. And it was actually working okay until everything went wrong during the pandemic. So my instinct is that we'll find our way back there, but I'm very, very, very cautious about that. If I'm right, that means that the return I'll be able to get in dividend stocks will probably be rubbish, because they will trade with low yields, because why wouldn't they? People would be willing to buy them at anything other than low yields, because they can't get any kind of income anywhere else from something. So switching over to dividend stocks when the time comes means, I suspect, probably quite a low safe withdrawal rate. I would guess around the 3% or below the sort of 4 that I hear talked about a fair bit. Safe is what it is here, but I think in terms of what you could find in low-risk defensive stocks, I would be surprised if it was very high. I think one plan you might have, I mean, with the stuff I have at the moment, there's sort of three categories of it. There's stuff that doesn't pay a dividend, which is stuff like Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon is another good example, so on. Weatherspoon's the third. Stuff that really does pay a decent dividend, stuff like Realty Income, Primary Health Properties in my case, and Doc Martens as well, actually, now. And stuff that does but might as well not, by which I mean stuff like Apple, effectively. That pays a dividend, but realistically, I don't think anyone's buying that for the dividend. My instinct is that the kind of companies I own will be paying out more over time, or I'll have a way of making more over time than I am at the moment. And that will either be because I'll reinvest stuff, or it will be because these dividends will go up organically, or they will start capital returns in a way that they're currently not. So Berkshire already does share buybacks every so often, so you can sell out part of your holding without diluting your stake in the company. So there's some may switch to that rather than dividends. Some may start that as well as dividends and so on. But my feeling is that by the time I get to retirement, most things will be in some form of capital return mechanism, and they will do so in a lot of cases having built themselves to a significant size that, okay, even if the yield is low, then it will be higher based on what I've been paying recently for this thing. So my sense is that I'm going to not worry too much about safe withdrawal rates and just see where I get to and then work it out when I kind of get there a little bit. But Steve, have you thought about safe withdrawal rates at all?
They're another thing that I think are mostly useless to investors. I don't think you should really get yourself into a mindset that you're going to take 3%, 4%, or 5% of your portfolio every year, and that's what you're going to live off. I think you should work out what the max you can take from a portfolio and how long it will last based on those scenarios. But you absolutely should be flexible in your withdrawal. If you don't need to take 5%, if you work on 5% withdrawal, and you build up a pot that's large enough to sustain a 5% withdrawal up until, say, you're 100 or whatever, you absolutely shouldn't take 5% if you don't need it in a year. You should just take the minimum that you need to survive that year. And also bear in mind that as you get older and older, you're going to become less and less mobile. You'll be, you know, spending less time on your yacht in Monaco and more time probably sat at home not doing as much. So I believe in front-loaded spending and a flexible withdrawal rate, i.e. If you're only going to go on one holiday, there's no need to draw money for three. So leave the pot intact. I think safe withdrawal rates are, again, one of the stupider things to have come out of finance recently.
It's interesting. Different things motivate different people. And since the question was asked of me, I speak for me and nobody else here. But thinking in terms of safe withdrawal rates, I can understand how that might motivate somebody. Equally, if someone thinks, okay, look, so my retirement number or whatever is, let's say it's 750,000 or something, and here's where I am now, and I want to retire in 20 years, so I need to be this rate, and then this number, and then this number, and then this number, and then this number, and eventually I'll get to 750,000. But I'll check in annually to see how I'm doing. Lots of YouTube videos of people kind of mapping their journey like that, which is, I mean, I wish them well, and I hope it works, and I'm glad it keeps them motivated. It would horrify me, the idea that I've set myself a sort of target after year one or three or whatever, and something happens in the market that has nothing to do with me and basically nothing to do with anything, and ordinarily I wouldn't worry about, but I now have to show up, make a video and say, yeah, I didn't make my target this year because this thing happened, and I'm okay, it's all right, the target wasn't really a target, and so on. I think I'd feel horrible trying to make a video like that that said, here's what I was aiming for and I missed it. It's one of the reasons that I rarely, very, very rarely these days, announce what my kind of goals are, because I don't want to have to tell you that I missed them if I do, especially if I'm going to then try and tell you I missed it, but it's basically okay because the stock market goes up and down, and over the long term I think it will go up, and I'll keep investing and keep sticking to the process and trusting in the long-term approach and so on and so forth. And if I really mean that, well, then I probably oughtn't to have set you a kind of three-year target and said, here's where I'll be in 3 years or so. Or even got excited because I'm ahead, because there's always a down around the corner even when you're up. The general trajectory might be up, but it's not great, I think, in these cases to get overexcited if you happen to be ahead of the curve at one point, or particularly beat down on yourself if you're behind it. So planning this far ahead sort of seems tricky to me, but my instinct is I'd like to keep investing the way I am, and if I have to, I'll bang it all into utilities or something.
It's one of the things people forget to do. So when they look at their lives at the moment, they say to themselves, like, right, okay, so I can live on 20k a year. So basically, I'll think I'll live for, say, 30 years after I retire. So 30 times 20, I need a pot of 600k. But what people seem to forget that, say, if you're 30 years away from retiring, well, that 20k becomes 48k. And then if you stay retired for 30 years, that 48 becomes something a lot larger. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of people who are, if you're not going to factor in inflation into your calculations for you working out your pot, then there is almost no reason to work out the pot at all. So it's a difficult one, Steve. I think that's why I think largely a lot of it is kind of guesswork, and I think largely a lot of that, because it's such a horrible thing to guess, and then you're going to have to constantly refine it. It's almost not worth your time. I think the idea should be to build up the biggest pot you can possible, and not limit yourself by saying I'm a dividend investor, and if it doesn't pay a dividend, I can't buy it, or I'm a growth investor, and if it pays a dividend, I won't buy it, or anything along that kind of ilk. I'm an ETF investor only. And can you imagine saying I'm an ETF investor only and being the world's foremost person on Rolls Royce during the pandemic, and saying no, I'm an ETF investor, so I absolutely won't put my, $5,000 into Rolls Royce or whatever. It's just one of those things, isn't it? I think, I think people get really sort of like, for whatever reason, they get red and blue sort of footballification entrenched in either camp, and this is the only way to do it. And it tends to be the wrong way. And I've been saying to people for the last couple of months, this will elongate the amount of time that you work. If your job or what you want to do is retire early, and you are sticking in the camp of I am only a dividend investor, then that will elongate your the length of time that you'll be working. You have to understand that, entrenching yourself in that camp, that's what it's going to do to you. That's the downfall of it. So it's not about looking for the fastest growing company or looking for the companies with the biggest yield. It's not about that. It's all about total return, and that's all that matters.
It's really interesting kind of getting yourself stuck into a mindset like that. It's one thing if that's how you naturally think, that's okay, you can work to that. But arguably the biggest advantage the likes of you and me have over the hedge funds and so on is that we're not limited by any kind of asset allocation requirements. We don't have to put a certain amount of our money in the UK. We don't have to put a certain amount of it in the US. We don't have to be diversified in this way, that way, or any other way that we want to. And our ambition doesn't have to be to try and generate 5% a year in dividends, which is another thing that some of them have to do. And that means we can buy a load of stuff that the guys who are, say, required to track an index or have a certain amount in the UK might really want to buy but can't buy because they've got to work out how to go and buy it in a way that maintains their weighting towards the UK or their 5% annual return or something. If the bottom fell out of Amazon tomorrow... not tomorrow, that's the weekend, it's a Friday today, but if the bottom fell out of Amazon on Monday or something, it would be fine for us to buy it. It would not be fine for someone who's exclusively limited to UK stocks or dividend stocks or anything else stocks to go taking advantage of that. And that's probably, I think, the biggest edge that the likes of us have. However, if you know any YouTubers who are motivated by these kind of calculations and considerations and you think they do a good job of them, we'd be interested to hear about them, because Steve and I tend to think these calculations are probably more trouble than they're worth in terms of what we ought to be aiming for and making plans to shunt from one asset class to another sort of when the time comes. However, if there are strong reasons why we ought not to do that, we'd be interested in knowing that, because in my case anyway, I don't think about it a huge amount because I've decided it's not something I'm going to spend a huge amount of time thinking over because I'm not sure there's much to be gained from it. Be interested to know if I'm wrong about that or if some other YouTubers who have more content on this sort of thing have something I ought to see, basically.
Yeah, just point us in the direction. Be very interested in seeing that. Steve, what's next?
More stuff about retirement, Steve. Trading 212 is starting to get stuck into our retirement. What's happening there, Steve?
Yeah, interesting one from Trading 212. So they've had a SIP thread on their community for a long time. So people who just don't, if you don't know what a SIP is, it's a self-invested, is it personal pension? Is that what it stands for?
Yeah,
I think that's what it stands for. And basically, it's a pension. I do have one, but I've never actually thought to think about what it stands for. But yeah, so you can use this pension, it's self-managed, and you can use it to invest in whatever you like. So a lot of the major providers have them. I think it's Hargreaves. I don't think Interactive Brokers have one yet, but I know Interactive Investor have one, AJ Bell have one, Vanguard, if I didn't already say that. InvestEngine, and of course the biggest provider of all, Freetrade, they have one. Although you probably have to pay about $5,000 a month for it or something. And you can only access stocks that they choose to let you. So Trading212 waded in and said, recently we've been rolling out other features, see the What's New category, and there is some more exciting stuff in the works. However, we also have plans to introduce SIP accounts this year. Now, I thought it was a typo, so I wrote back to them and said, look, just check in. We have, or is that meant to say don't have? And they responded and put, no, it's not a typo. We do have such plans. And they also, I asked a few other questions and also found out that portfolio transfers are actually going to go live at the end of this month. They reckon they'll be out to all customers, and they'll also apply to SIP accounts when they are introduced. So it looks like Trading 212, Steve, are about to open a SIP. I have a SIP. Mine's with Vanguard. I will wait and see what the offer is before I move over there. I cannot imagine it'll be free, because SIPs have quite a lot of administrative processes behind them to claim all the tax back and what have you. But Steve, would Trading 212 introducing a SIP be of interest to you? Because you don't have one, right?
I do not have one. It's a tempter. I have to date elected to invest pretty much purely into a stocks and shares ISA for the following reasons. One, it's on Trading 212 and free. And two, you can draw down from them before you hit retirement, which you can't do with a SIP. You pay tax on the way in, effectively, with the stocks and shares ISA. So there's no tax on withdrawals, but it comes out of your salary, which you paid tax on when you earned it. So I am getting to the point where I'm starting to wonder. We're approaching a new financial year, and next year's ISA situation is looking promising, and then I have an option about what I try and do. I can either stick some stuff into a GIA, which is what I've done this year, or I can try to bang it into a SIP and think, let's get it out of the way for longer. I mean, in that situation, I'd be very unlikely to be trading around in that. I don't really trade around. I'm doing a better job of not churning my portfolio. I say that. It's been a tricky week for that one. But in general, I am doing a better job of not churning my portfolio and my stocks and shares ISA. But I feel I almost certainly wouldn't touch stuff in a pension. It'd just be a case of buy it and sit it there for the foreseeable. So it's got to be tempting to have a go at part of that. You get is it 20% boost, which is basically the sort of tax you paid away on it, Steve, from for investing in a SIP?
I should check that, shouldn't I? Is it 25?
Is it 25? That's impressive. It's 25 and a LISA. So if that's the case, then a LISA is a combination of it's basically a SIP, effectively. You can't withdraw the thing unless you try and buy a house with it or retire or hit terminal illness, but I think there might be similar rules on pensions for that. But yeah, that'll be interesting to me. If I go the SIP route, which I'm not certain I will, it'll be Trading 212 that are probably at the top of my list. I, like you, will be waiting to see what the cost of that looks like, if there is a cost, and if they can make the step to working out how to charge fees for something. You're not an avid user of your SIP then, Steve, if you're not quite sure how much of a boost you get.
You know, I've never actually... I know I get it, but I've never actually figured out what it is. I know, obviously, I can claim... it is, yeah, so it's 20%, yeah, and you get 20% back that I can claim off my self-assessment as well. So it's because I'm in a higher rate tax band. So yeah, I absolutely love my SIP to bits. I do put quite a bit of money, and I put a regular contribution into it, and I put an annual contribution in as well, which is quite a bit larger when I receive the dividends and what have you. So yeah, I do genuinely like my SIP. At the moment, it's just with Vanguard. I only have one fund. I just have it in the global all cap index and nothing else. It's an accumulating index. I don't even have to do anything with it. But yeah, very interesting. So what I do, just for the people at home who are curious, is my workplace pension is with the BNCE People's Pension. It's very limited on what you can pick from. In fact, you have to fart around with it just to get a 100% equity version. And even so, it's completely overweighted to the UK, and the performance on it is absolutely shocking. So what I do is I let it build up to a couple of grand, and then I just transfer it over, and I transfer it into my SIP. And I just keep doing that over and over and over again every time it gets to a couple of grand. And then I contribute monthly 250 quid to my SIP, and then, like I say, top it up annually with whatever I can spare. So, yeah, trading 2-on-2, opening up a SIP is interesting to me. Vanguard charged me fees to have the SIP open. I get an account fee. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to me if trading 2-on-2 come out with a competitive product, Steve. Then, yeah, definitely something I would look to move over and potentially utilize.
You say later this not this financial year. There's only a month of it left, less than that, about 3 weeks. But this calendar year, you were saying?
Yeah, this calendar year is what they've said. So they've been very good at delivering features so far. So yeah, keep your eyes out for it.
Speaking of delivering features, as someone who uses the Trading 212 web app or website, basically, for we'll come back to reasons why. Things look quite different there, Steve. It took you to point it out to me and flip my screen over to the new viewing thing, but what's the idea behind that, do you know?
Yeah, so the idea was that Trading 212 had been trying to sort of like unify the code between their web and their tablet and their phone apps. And one of the ways they needed to do that, or one of the things that needed majorly changing, was the web app, because it was running off something completely different. And so if you use the web app, go to trading212.com and log in, although the login button seemed to be hidden for me. But once you find it and log in, there'll be a button in the top left-hand corner to switch it on to the new beta, and you'll be able to see the new web app. So it's now got trading view charts. Steve and I had a little play on that before we came on, drawing some lines and saying that made the stock was going up. I also noticed that it loads up in dark mode as well, which is great. It looks better on the eyes. And there's also the social space now, which you will see I'm a fairly prominent and active member of, tormenting people in usually. So yeah, it looks pretty good. If you want to use the advanced view, you have to click on the home button, and you'll see that it switches from standard to advanced view, and you get all the fancy charts and bits and pieces. And to me, it looks pretty well laid out. I'm quite enjoying having a play with it as we speak. Like I said, it is a beta, so if it doesn't work for you, or you encounter a bug, or if there's something you really really want them to add, or if you feel like there's something missing, or you know, even if something you just don't like some part of the design, I would encourage you to drop onto their community, community.trading212.com, and find the thread and just give them some constructive feedback for them to build upon. They're seeking it at the moment. And yeah, if you can offer it, I would go and do so. Steve, you've had a play with it a bit more than me. I've not really used the web app before today, but I quite like the look of it. Does it look better for you?
I very regularly use the web app, actually. I'm a big fan of using the computer. It somehow feels more like proper investing than doing it on my phone, which sort of makes me feel more like a Robin Hood type. But when I flipped over to the beta earlier, my initial instinct, and I got myself into advanced view because I consider myself to be an advanced trading 212 user, my initial view was that I hated it. I thought it looked like a mess, and I haven't enjoyed any update that they've made to their web thing since they started doing it. But then I actually realized what it's for, and it occurred to me that actually you can kind of customize it a fair bit and have what you want on your kind of left-hand panel and your right-hand panel and your bottom panel, and now I think it's great. I really like in Trading 212 the news feature that they've been developing lately. I'm having the kind of news stuff that tells you, well, at least what's going on with businesses. Let's not say why stocks are doing what they're doing. That's slightly more ephemeral sometimes. But I like having that news pane up the left-hand side where I've got it. And what I really like is that they've brought back a feature that they got rid of on the previous update and I've been missing very much, which was the ability to have all of your limit orders where you can see them, all of your price alerts where you can see them at the bottom. So previously, if I had a limit order for Realty Income or something set, I would have had to go look at Realty Income and then scroll down and it would have said limit order this at this for me. Nowadays, I just get on there and it's got all my limit orders down the bottom and I can see what they all are and when they're likely to go off, if they're likely to go off, and I can see my portfolio, my account, my return, all of it nicely on a one screen view. I guess it's brought back what I think is the best of the kind of original version of the website. I don't see myself as a trader much, so I'm less in need of some of the more technical features that they have there, and abilities to recognise head and shoulders patterns and two hump camels and so on and so forth. But what it is very helpful for is seeing the things that I want to see without having to swipe around and scroll around and that kind of thing. I've always had it in dark mode. I'm a big fan of that as well. So yeah, I like it. I think it's going to take a little bit of getting used to, but broadly speaking, it is a step towards, I think, bringing together the best bits of the most recent version of the web app and the kind of original version, where I was slightly sad that some of those features went away on the most recent one.
Yeah, I agree with that, Steve. I've just found that button that you were talking about, and I can see I don't have any pending orders at the moment. I very rarely place limit orders and things like that. But yeah, I can see where they'd all be stashed. And also, there's a huge list here, Steve, of price alerts that I've set over the year, and I just had a good scroll through them, and it's an annoyingly long list. And companies that I'd forgotten I set that I'd set price alerts on, so it might be nice for me to go through that and clear some of them out. But yeah, I really like the look of it, Steve. I saw that there was initially some quite negative feedback about it. There was a few people who were complaining. Apparently on a larger, you know, the really big curved screens, it kind of like shuffles itself to the middle, which is obviously an issue that they need to address. But yeah, I don't really have a problem with this. Like I say, same as you, Steve, I'm not going to use these trading view charts. I don't fully understand what I'm looking at here. I've never been interested in technical analysis, and I've yet to be convinced of its actual use. I read a book on somebody who started the book by saying, "I'm going to convince you of the usefulness of technical analysis," and got to the end of the book and I said nope. So I don't know, Steve. I think it looks pretty good, and I would encourage everybody to go and have a play with it and see what they think. And if you've got some feedback, you know, feel free to drop it off. I'll put a link in the description if you want to find that community, because it's not the one that's in the app, it's a different one. And yeah, drop your feedback and let them know what you think.
Yeah, so interesting to see 212 doing new things. I haven't paid attention to any other platforms very much recently. AJ Bell appears to be broadly where it is. That's where the junior ISA is for the little fella. But shall we move ourselves on then, Steve, to some actual stocks and stuff?
Let's do it.
Okay, so one earnings report this week. At least one that we were interested in covering, and it's Adobe. Adobe is down around 15% today after its earnings came out, which is a significant drop by anyone's standards. The report that I read from CNBC is that it's down on guidance being quite soft. Make of it what you will, and see if you can work out whether or not this fall is justified, whether the price deserved to be up there, whether it's 15% worse of a company than it was before. But see what you think. So revenue came in, and this is, by the way, for this is the first of what I think is the 2024 Q1 earnings updates. We're sort of in an interesting period at the moment where some companies are sort of wrapping up 2023 and some are starting to talk about 2024. Adobe has decided that the quarter has already finished 2 weeks early. So on we go to thinking about what's been happening this year. Revenue came in for the first 3 months of this year at $5.18 billion, which was an 11% increase on the previous year. Earnings per share came in at $1.36, which was a 50% decline. Under the hood, that's being weighed on a significant amount by a $1 billion fee that they had to pay to Figma, who they were trying to acquire. We talked about this on that show a little while ago. Stopped by the mighty UK regulators. So there's a severance fee for Adobe, which is $1 billion. That goes off to Figma, and that weighs on Adobe's earnings for the most recent quarter, taking them down to $1.36 per share. If you adjust it, and maybe this is a case where you might want to at least think about adjusting it, it is a real expense, but very unlikely to be repeated. The earnings per share figure comes in at $4.48, which is an 18% increase over the first quarter of last year. Operating margins, because we do think about Adobe's margins quite a bit. We think of this as a sort of fairly mature-ish tech company, and that gives us an idea for what some of the early stage growthy things might look like once they hit scale. Were 17.5% if you use GAAP accounting, and 47.6% if you use non-GAAP accounting. So quite a significant shift between those two things, but certainly one of those numbers for an operating margin, by the way, not a gross margin, is very, very high. Closing in on sort of 48% operating margin is impressive. They break their stuff down in a number of ways, actually. Their investor relations page and their report of their earnings is, I think, terrific. If you're looking to get your head around it and which bits of Adobe and their various apps and products and so on fit into which category, it's a really good place to look. The last couple of pages has a terrific diagram of here's how we categorize stuff and here's where we think all these things fall and here's how we're reporting all of this. So they report by geography, they report by segment, they report by various other things as well, and breakdowns within them. So digital media, which is their sort of creative and document based stuff, which is about 3/4 of the overall revenue, was up revenue wise by about 12%. Their Adobe Experiences thing, which as far as I can tell looks like more commercial stuff to do with analytics, commerce and campaign and marketing and that sort of thing, was 10% up. So it's nearly the balance, by the way. It's nearly sort of 25% of their business, that part of things. One of the interesting things about Adobe, as far as I was thinking about them, is they look like an obvious potential AI winner. They look like not someone who's going to be doing massive research into AI, but the kind of organization that could benefit quite significantly by producing better products, by integrating AI, and therefore being able to do more stuff, improve outputs for their customers, and therefore benefit by charging higher prices for their kind of AI-boosted stuff. And they're in the process of, or they're busy beta testing something as well. They're beta testing assistance for Acrobat and for their reader documents, which reader programs, which will be interesting to see how those things go. I mean, Adobe and Photoshop seems kind of synonymous with AI and the ways I've thought about it being used, but the stock is coming down despite all of this, and the reason is apparently being put down to guidance. So looking ahead to the next quarter, in terms of earnings per share, they're looking at somewhere within the $4.35 to $4.40 range. That would imply growth over a year ago of between 54% and 56%. Wall Street was looking for around 438, which is pretty much bang in the middle of the range they've offered. It's fractionally over the half, but it's as good as makes no difference halfway. Revenues are guiding a little touch lower, so they're guiding for 5.25 billion to 5.3 billion, which is up either 9% or 10%, depending on which number you take compared to Q2 of 2023. Wall Street was looking for 5.31. Billion, so it's a slight under, and apparently that's enough to kind of knock down the market cap by about 15%, or cause people to think, well, maybe they didn't ought to have let the market cap get that high. They ought to have kept it 15% lower. They're expecting accelerated growth in the second half of the year, though. OpenAI are busy working on or bringing out their kind of AI video generating thing, and Adobe made the point on their earnings call that more videos means more demand for video editing. And video editing is a thing that Adobe has pretty much a good hold on, I think, or at least they're well up there here. So they're expecting that, yeah, earnings, I mean, they talked about earnings growth accelerating in Q3 and Q4. Accelerating from 54 and 56% would be something to see. But, I mean, revenues can push higher, I guess, between the sort of 9 to 10% growth. There's a share buyback coming. It's 21 billion. That's about 11% of the market cap, or it was when I looked. The rate that stock is going down, it's probably about 80% of the market cap by now, but call it 11% for the time being. That's coming over the next 4 years, so that will be spread out a little bit, your 11% return. It's not Lloyd's, and they're not busy hammering all their cash into shareholder returns just yet. The stock kind of looks expensive, but when you have something with a Figma-like hit attached to it, it's important to note that when you start screening, the PE number is going to look wonky for a little bit. It's going to look wonky for 12 months because your earnings per share came in at about came in significantly lower than they should have been in the first quarter. So right now it looks like sort of 48 on a GAAP accounting basis when I tried to add it up. That comes down to 37 if you start thinking of it as non-GAAP, and that's actually quite a significant shunt. If they keep going at sort of 10% per year, which is fairly conservative, it looks like a PE of 13 after 10 years. Sorry, if they go at 15% a year, it's a PE of 7 after 10 years. This company has basically been a machine, Steve. Look, getting fined $1 billion for not managing to acquire Figma is not nothing, but it is only one thing. Encouraged by this report?
I actually think this is a pretty decent report. I went through it a little bit last night, and I'm going through it again now while you was just presenting the figures then, Stephen. There's really nothing in this report that is a red flag. The only red flag that I could find in the whole thing is that miss on the guidance estimate. But the miss is like 0.2%. So there's really not anything in this report that isn't pretty good. The Figner breakup fee is unfortunate, but I think now that Firefly has taken off and the way it has, I actually think Adobe doesn't really need Figma. The margins are all really strong. A lot of them are improving. Obviously, the net margin, we've discussed why that has not grown, but that's looking pretty good. Digital media gross margin is now 95.5%, which is absolutely incredible, really, when you think about how strong that is as a gross margin. It's not hard to see how some of that eventually flows onto the bottom line. And remaining performance obligation, Steve, is up 15.6% year on year. They've got about 17.6 billion in there. Creative annual revenue rate is now 12.78 billion. That was up 13.3% year on year. So these growth figures you're putting out there, Steve, are not they're not a million miles away from what Adobe can comfortably achieve here. I think potentially they've sandbagged a little bit on this revenue guide only 10% year on year. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up beating that estimate. So, I mean, we're looking at their growth rate now. If you look back over the last, 8 quarters, it's been 14, 13, 10, 9, 10, 10, 12, 11% in terms of revenue growth rate. And RPO is shooting off into the distance. It was about 9% in Q4 2022. If you look at it today, RPO is growing at 16%. So expect some of that to flow down onto that top line. So yeah, I think this is a fine report, Steve. I can't really spot anything wrong with this. Certainly nothing that would send it down 15.6% year to date. It's not having a very good year. It's at $489. This is around the areas I quite like to buy Adobe. So it's another one of those things that I'm going to have to stick on the list and have a look at. The only other news I could find out about it, Steve, was that it has repeated the mistakes that Google's Gemini did when Google took its kick in for having black German soldiers, I think, and black Vikings, I think, when prompted, rather than, I guess, what people wanted to say is, you know, there was no black Vikings or whatever. So yeah, interesting. Interesting that could be the reason, I guess, if we were going to try and pin a reason on it. I think there's not really an awful lot wrong with this report, though. Adobe back onto the watch list of things that we should be thinking about again, Steve.
I'll be interested to find out if they were sort of sandbagging in 3 months' time, because I mean, the stock has taken a noticeable hit as a result of probably lower guidance. I feel like with Adobe, in terms of AI screw-ups, I'm very inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt here. I feel like if it's going to work in this space, Adobe will be the ones to make it work here. That's not obvious to me that there's a meaningful competitor even on the horizon in this case. And it's either the case the AI will work well enough to create genuine value, in which case Adobe will be the main sort of beneficiary of that in this industry, or it won't, in which case it won't make any difference. And Adobe will have, okay, presumably sunk a bit of cost into it, but that they will be more than fine as a result. This was one of the kind of companies that I thought could be a kind of, not under the radar, but less obvious AI opportunity here. It's not an Nvidia type. They're not busy making chips. They're not busy making parts for chips. They don't really make anything to do with chips. And if you thought picks and shovels plays were overrated, because they don't always work, picks and shovels, sometimes they do, sometimes they go less well. If we think sort of that Cisco was the picks and shovels play of the internet age, that went up quite quickly and then came down again quite quickly, and shareholders are still waiting to get their money back. Not saying it will go that way, but if you think that's what NVIDIA might be heading towards, or you think there's any kind of danger for that for NVIDIA, Adobe looks to me like an interesting way to sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say diversify, it's all big US tech, but an interesting option to consider if you're wanting exposure to the AI revolution, which is not typically the way I think about things, but I can see it might be important here.
The only thing that really, I've just spotted something that has grown a little bit, which is maybe something to keep an eye on, but stock-based compensation.
Is it stock-based compensation? Yeah. I was going to say, it must be stock-based compensation.
Yeah, divided by revenue is at 9%. That's up 1 percentage point Q-on-Q, so that's up quite a bit. Although dilution's actually up minus 1.3% year-on-year. It's presumably because they've done quite a few buybacks in that year. So, just one to keep an eye on there, I think. But there's not a lot in this report that I don't like here, Steve. I'm very tempted to whack this one back on the list of things to potentially buy again.
I sort of feel the same way a little bit here. I mean, if you're thinking, look for opportunities for things that are growing when they have sort of minor downturns. Business is in fine shape. The only question, I suppose, is price. But if they're going to step that up again, so price is always part of an equation, right? Price is part of what's business going to do, and is it worth that price? It's not just high by itself. I can see a sort of sign saying, 10% revenue growth for 40 times earnings is about right with where the stocks maybe got knocked down to there. That's not crazy. But if things are going to kind of step up in the second half of the year, this could be some very short-term thinking. I'm a little bit surprised with Adobe. I said this a lot about some of the end-of-year reports that we saw, that if you're paying attention over the course of the year, there wasn't that much to surprise you. There was only Q4 to kind of add on when we report end-of-year earnings. But with Adobe, a lot of this was also fairly telegraphable, right? I mean, the Figma breakup thing was known about. That was clearly going to come at some point. You could have told exactly what the number was. So earnings come in looking low for a quarter. That ought not to be surprising anyone. If Q2 comes in low, it could get interesting, I guess. But I like you, I'm sort of doubtful that's going to happen, Steve.
Yeah, I think we've potentially been sandbagged here, and I don't know what has caused the market to bite quite like this. It would be one of those stocks that you'd be quite surprised to see it drop this 15% and then immediately recover as the human hands take back over, as if to say, like, the algorithm's messed up here. But yeah, I can't see a reason for it to be like this, and I would again, Adobe seems to almost always recover, and I think this will be another occasion where we will probably see that.
One for a bit more investigation, I think. One thing you can almost guarantee with Adobe is that operationally, anyway, it's going to have very, very attractive looking numbers once you get past one-time hits and stuff, because of the type of business it is. It's a big, mature tech company with big, mature tech margins as well. But maybe one to look at over the coming weeks for us. Anyway, that's got us through the hour mark. So thank you all very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time next week, brought to you once again by Trading 212. But bye for now.